kind of a tough presentation to follow, so hopefully I will be talking a little bit about a happier subject, which is research opportunities and money for these research opportunities. So let me first start by saying that I have no relation, financial or other relationships to disclose. And over the next half hour or so, I want to give a reminder about what the Air Force Health Study is and the types of data and assets that were collected over the duration of it, and then what happened when the Institute of Medicine became the custodian of the data and materials, and then the most exciting part, potential research opportunities with these assets. So first things first, the Air Force Health Study, if many of you recall, was started by the Air Force in 1979, and after several rounds of review and revisions, we got the final protocol, which was then published in 1982. And so now this protocol called for a 20-year morbidity study on two cohorts, the first of which was, as Arnie was saying, those Air Force pilots and crew and ground crew who actually participated in the herbicide spraying missions, and so known as the ranchhanders. And then we had a matched cohort of pilots, crew, and ground crew that were deployed to Vietnam around the same time, but did not have anything to do with the spraying missions. And so the protocol called for 6 years, or 6 cycles of follow-up on these two cohorts over a 20-year period, starting with the baseline, then years 3, 5, 10, 15, and 20. And as you can see, there is a great cost to collect this data and use it. So this is just a visual of the AFHS timeline. Of course, you can see the exposure period, which is the herbicide spraying missions in Vietnam from 1962 to 1971. We have the initiation of the study in 1979, and then you can see the 6 exam cycles, the last one being in 2002, and then the termination of the original Air Force study in 2006. Okay. So the protocol called for 3 components of the Air Force Health Study. The first is the mortality study. And so this was data collected through all the big sources. So we had the Social Security Index, we had VA systems, National Death Index, and they basically collected the date of death and the primary and secondary underlying causes of death. And as you can see, it contained about 20,000 subjects. So there was also a retrospective morbidity study, and so this was just a one-time cross-sectional survey. But then we have the prospective morbidity study, and that's the one that we all talk about as really the Air Force Health Study. And so the subjects that were in the prospective morbidity study, the controls anyway, were the same ones that were in the retrospective morbidity study, but only they were replaced for those who had died in the course of the study or were lost to follow-up or so forth. But let's focus on the morbidity study. So as you can see, there were a whole bunch of health outcomes and endpoints that were examined. And this is everything from your endocrine and pulmonary and general health to psychiatric outcomes and cardiovascular and even reproductive outcomes. Okay. So during each exam cycle, there's a whole bunch of data gathered. And so this is just some of them. From the laboratory, we had blood draws, urine and semen collection, adipose tissue, chest x-rays, ECGs, psychological testing, many, many, many other things were collected in the course of this. But along with the physical exam, there's also a questionnaire. And so it's a very, very thick questionnaire, if anybody's seen it. And this collected all sorts of information each time on your typical socio-demographic factors, marital and fertility history, which I don't know of any other epidemiologic study that did that with veterans, health habits, physical activities, military experience, just about everything you can possibly think of. Okay. So this is just to give you some numbers of the amount and types of data that are available to use in, or for study. In all, as you can see, there were 2,758 subjects that participated in at least one exam, but many participated in several or even all of the exams. For example, for the last exam in 2002, 75% of those eligible ranch hands, so those who were not deceased and were able to attend, actually did. So I put this table up here just to show you a bit of a visual on the type of biospecimens that were collected and maintained. And so across the top, you can see the exam cycle and the year that it was collected. Down the right-hand column, you can see the total number of samples that are held in our freezers. And then on the left, you can see the type of samples, so blood serum being collected in all six of the cycles. You have other materials like whole blood, semen, and adipose tissue that were only collected at a single time point. And then things like urine that were collected in the first three cycles. Okay. So given all of that information, the question is, has anything been shown in the scientific literature? Has it contributed to it? And the answer is yes. There have been papers on pharmacokinetics of TCDD and its half-life, Vietnam veterans' health status, associations between herbicide exposure and health effects such as type 2 diabetes, and even spina bifida in the children of these veterans, or exposed veterans, I should say. Okay, so that brings us to the disposition of the Air Force Health Study. And this, let me make sure I get the public law right, was Public Law 183 by Congress charged the Institute of Medicine to convene a committee to evaluate the scientific merit of retaining and maintaining the medical records, study data, and laboratory specimens collected over the course of the AFH study when the study was set to terminate in 2006. So the IOM committee took a look at this question and had several conclusions and recommendations on the many topics you see here, but really the take-home points were these. The AFHS data and assets are unique. No other epidemiologic data set on Vietnam veterans contains as much detailed information over as long of a period of time, 20 years, remember, was the follow-up. The data collected appear to be of high quality, and more importantly, the specimens appear to be well-preserved. Analysis of the AFHS data set has contributed to the literature, as I just showed you on the previous slide. And therefore, not only is there scientific merit in retaining and maintaining these assets after the scheduled termination date in 2006, but further study of them is recommended, or is advisable. All right. So following the recommendations of that report, Congress then passed Public Law 109-364, which directed the Air Force to transfer custodianship of the AFHS assets to the Institute of Medicine. Now, if anybody has ever been to the Institute of Medicine, you'll know that we are an office building in the middle of D.C., and we do not have in-house capacity to maintain the biospecimens ourselves. And so we have a contract with the research laboratory at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base in Dayton, Ohio, to store and maintain the specimens for us. And again, what's important to note is when there was a transfer of custodianship from the Air Force to the Institute of Medicine, we had to seek permission from the cohort members to transfer their data. And over 95% of them did consent. Okay, so as an epilogue to the report, the disposition of the Air Force study, Congress then passed the Veterans Benefit Improvement Act in 2008. So not only asking IOM to be the custodians of these materials, but to maintain and manage them as well. and allow such additional research as considered appropriate, really to understand determinants of health and promote wellness among not only this cohort of veterans, but the bigger cohort of veterans as well. And the Department of Veterans Affairs was directed to provide funding to support the maintenance of these assets. So now I'm going to talk about what the Institute of Medicine is doing and the research program that we have started to use these assets. So it kind of consists of five different parts. The first one is soliciting proposals from qualified researchers, then subjecting the submissions to rigorous scientific and IRB review. Then we have build and work collaboratively with the research applicants. Disseminate support money to those innovative pilot studies, if awarded, and then really promoting publication of these new research results and findings. So I'm going to talk about each part of these in a little bit more detail. So the first, soliciting proposals from qualified researchers. The first request for proposals was posted in May of 2012, and then we had a follow-up in October of 2012, with the current RFP posted in January of 2013. So proposals are open to just about any qualified researcher. This could include academics, government, non-government, industry, private sector researchers. International applicants are also welcome to apply. Interested researchers must first submit the letter of intent, and then if approved, they are invited to submit a full proposal. Now, when I was talking about money, we have $250,000 a year that the committee is able to award to those innovative research projects or pilot studies. And individuals may request up to $75,000 per proposal. This is, of course, subject to committee discretion, but you are invited to ask up to that much. What changed in 2013 is that the proposals are no longer subject to deadlines. So we're on a rolling submission now, which is very helpful for persons who need either a little bit more time or, you know, want to work on something longer and are not ready for, let's say, a May deadline and want to submit in June. Successful proposal applicants are then notified within 4 to 6 weeks, depending on when they turn in the proposal. Okay. So after you turn in a proposal, what happens? We have a committee of nine that evaluates each proposal, and the evaluation is and review are based on the NIH study section process, which I think most people are familiar with. Committee expertise, as you can see, is in many, many fields, including epidemiology, environmental science, statistics, bioethics, aging, veterans health, toxicology. And so once the proposal passes scientific merit, the next step is an investigator must go back to their institution and get IRB approval. Once they have IRB approval from their institution, it must then go through the National Academy of Sciences IRB. All right, but once all that is said and done, we begin collaborating with the investigators. And so first things first is, of course, disseminating any awarded pilot funding. And then we start working with not just me, but we have a whole data side to make the data set specific to your proposal. And if the proposal has requested access to or use of some of the biospecimens, that's when we start working with the research laboratory at Wright-Patterson to select, retrieve, and ship those biospecimens to the lab. Now, what we ask from the investigators is two things. First, annual progress updates on where you're at, what's working, what's not, and this is kind of a feedback loop for us so we can make the process better and more efficient. And then also, we really want to promote publication of the research results that were found, so that's very important to us. Okay. I'm just going to go over a few of the examples of some of the approved studies that are in progress. And these include, we actually have two researchers using different methods to estimate dioxin exposure and to use these revised estimates to then determine associations on health outcomes. One's looking at cardiovascular diseases and the other's looking at pulmonary diseases. We have a researcher who's looking at the specific chemical components in the herbicides and the association with Parkinson's disease and other related motor functioning outcomes. We have a researcher who is testing serum samples over three different clinical exam cycles to investigate whether dioxin is a risk for or influences the progression of monoclonal gammopathy of undetermined significance, which is basically an immune cell, malignant immune cell dysfunction. And then we have a researcher who's actually around here in Boston looking at matched serum and adipose tissue samples, looking at the effect of exposure to dioxin on preclinical markers of amyloidosis. A couple more, just to give you a broad range of some of these studies that were approved and some of these being funded. We have a researcher looking at the general association between cognitive function in midlife and later adult life. We have one researcher who has actually worked with the AFH assets before and is continuing his work looking at changes in testosterone levels with big life events. So this would be marriage, divorce, having a child, and any effect that it has with diabetes. And then we have a researcher looking at or testing the serum to look at dioxin exposure in diabetes as confounding factors or effect modifiers, and looking at then the association with TCDD exposure. Okay. So that's what's kind of ongoing, but there are several opportunities for new and innovative research. So here's just some examples that hopefully you may be interested in, and that's using new statistical analyses and methods and models model herbicide and dioxin exposure on whatever health outcome you are interested in. You can look at other environmental, behavioral, occupational, and leisure exposures to herbicides on health outcomes. We invite you to reanalyze some of the outcomes that were examined in the original AFHS using different assumptions and approaches. There's the opportunity to expand the study's period of analysis. So we ended in 2002. Now that it's 2013, that's over 10 years later. You know, using publicly available information such as the National Death Index. And obviously other additional follow-up of some health or medical or morbidity outcomes. But what's important to notice is that this isn't applicable just to dioxin studies. There's so much data and voluminous data that we have that we can expand these studies to be more than just dioxin and herbicide exposure. So some studies that you or colleagues or students might be interested in are long-term health outcomes and changes in biomarkers or DNA methylation and other measures. Which kind of ties into new assays and technologies that weren't available during the original course of the study that can be used now. Using the biospecimens for early detection, identification of therapeutic targets, disease response markers, I mean, truly almost whatever you want. Investigations, and this one's important, in related but often overlooked fields. So I know a lot of you focus on dioxin and environmental epidemiology, but it can be expanded to areas like aging and geriatrics. Again, looking at other environmental, leisure, and occupational exposures on health outcomes. And again, other additional follow-up of the AFHS participants. So I wanted to point out, though, actually, that this is an RFP that 5 minutes? Oh, awesome. I'll be less than that. That NIH has just put out. And it seeks researchers who want to do analyses using existing data sets and stored biospecimens, such as the AFHS, to address clinical aging research questions. So this is just one opportunity that they're having funding too that you might want to explore. So before I leave this up here and talk about that for a second, I want to thank a few people. First of all, is the committee that reviews all of the proposals. And I also really want to thank the veterans who allow us to use their data daily. And then this is some of the program staff that this project would not be possible without. So I would like to give them a shout out too. And so let me go back to this. And this is our website, our main website, where if you go to it, you can find links to the letter of intent. You can also find all of the clinical exam forms, the questionnaires, all of the health endpoints that were measured, just a whole more background on the AFHS, just a whole plethora of information. We have some data dictionaries posted as well. So, and of course, if you have any questions, please email, and one of us will get back to you really quickly. So on that note, can I answer any questions? I don't think we've encountered that yet, but I am going to actually bat that over to Dr. David Tollerud, who is the chair of the committee. So if I may, Dr. Tollerud.
Jean, were you thinking beyond what NHANES does to more specifics, or would you be happy with an NHANES type publication?
Thank you.
Other questions, comments, criticism? The Air Force Health Study has had a little bit of criticism in its history.
That's true.
What's the controversy? Come on, listen.
Well, we only have two sessions, so I don't think we could possibly go beneath the surface.
Oh, dear.
But at all the socials tonight, with a few drinks, we could go into great detail.
I'll look for you guys.
David Tollerud is familiar with some. And then we have another presenter, David Butler, is born out now. So. Okay.
Can I say one thing? Also, if anybody is interested, we also have a real brief description, so just a one-page handout on the back table that talks about some of the data that's available, and then also the website, so you can go to get further information.
I would really encourage you to take a couple and give it to your colleagues who do aging research, because this is a phenomenal database for an interval of time that most people don't get studied, which is sort of early adulthood to age 60. So it's not pediatrics and it's not geriatrics, and I think it's a huge opportunity to study that. Really, really rich database and
Okay, thank you very much, Aaron.